Welcome to Political Rewind. We've got, as usual, a lot to talk about today. And joining us for our conversation, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. We always like to remind people they read you on Thursdays and Sundays in the actual newspaper, and then you oversee the Political Insider blog.
Which is hour to hour, day to day.
It's constant. You Non-stop. Can't get away from it.
No vacations.
And your colleague, Tamar Hellerman, is joining us from Washington. Tamar, I mentioned in a note to you that I was hoping you got some rest over the weekend. I assume you were part of the crowd that was up all night Thursday night.
Oh, man, what a week.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today. We'll talk about what's going on up there in the aftermath of the health care bill fail. Senator Nan Orrick is back with us today, Democratic senator. We always enjoy having you on, Nan, because you are never at a loss for an opinion about what we're discussing.
Well, I was up till 2 in the morning myself.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I couldn't. Couldn't turn it off.
Sitting at home somewhere or manning the barricades in protest at some...
I was watching on my kitchen TV.
Okay. And Brian Robinson, the Republican strategist, former communications director and deputy chief of staff to Governor Nathan Deal. Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm always asleep at 2 a.m.
Yeah, you and me.
It does not matter.
Unless the baby's up, right?
Well, that's really not my problem either.
Truth be told.
That is just the hard truth.
Somebody's coming home with flowers tonight.
I know. She earns it. But my wife is very good about doing those early morning hour baby pickups.
Let's just make one thing clear. That was Brian Robinson who said that, not Galloway, not me.
Right. The dad
so
of an 11 of a 10 month old.
Send your tweets to him, ladies. Before we start our conversation about healthcare and other matters in the news, there are some breaking news to report. The Wall Street Journal just reported within the last half hour that the Pentagon and State Department have devised a plan to supply Ukraine with anti-tank missiles and other weaponry, and they are going now to the White House seeking approval. The officials in the military said the arms, which are characterized as defensive, are meant to deter aggressive actions by Moscow, which the U.S. and others say has provided tanks and other sophisticated armaments, as well as military advisors to rebels fighting with the government in Kiev. That comes at the same time that Vice President Trump has been just visiting he's been in Estonia and is going to Montenegro, where he is also talking about the need for the U.S. to defend against aggression by the Russian neighbors of those two countries. Interesting, Jim. And, of course, it follows Congress passing the bill that would prevent the president from lifting sanctions on Russia.
Right. And this is the defense of West weapons to Ukraine is something that Republicans in Congress have been pushed all through the latter half of the Obama administration.
Yeah.
So I think this is a very, very interesting episode in American history in which you have Congress really seizing hold of foreign policy.
A lot of commentary to that effect, Jim, over the weekend that Vladimir Putin apparently thought that by interfering with the American election, and he had hoped helping Trump get elected, would have a friend and would be able to ease relations. And Brian, instead, there are those who say that we're at a worse point at any other time since the Cold War.
I'd say I am so heartened to see the vice president there along the old Iron Curtain, reiterating that America stands with these democracies against this potential invader with Russia, who is meddling in their affairs at every turn and actually invading in Ukraine. So I am so glad to see that the vice president's influence is winning out there, because I have been concerned for a very long time about President Trump's willingness to cozy up to dictators and autocrats and murderers. And so this is an embrace of American values, and I'm glad to see it. And on Jim's point about people in Congress reasserting control over foreign power, a great George Will column over the weekend about how the Trump presidency might create a swing back toward more power for the legislature, which, you know, from Will's perspective, is a desirable outcome.
You know, Nan, what's interesting about all this is, and this also comes right after Vladimir Putin announced that they were punishing the United States for the sanctions that were imposed by the Obama administration.
Yes.
Back when they caught the Russians trying to interfere with our election. Russia announced they're going to cut 755 U.S. diplomats from staffs in Russia to equalize the number of people they have here in our country. And yet, with all of this going on that concerns Russia, not a word in the tweets of President Trump himself. Curious, isn't it?
Yes, it's curious. Silence is has its own meaning. I do think that last week was a bellwether moment in the sense that the Congress began taking back some power, and the separation of the balance of powers and the separation of the different parts of our federal government started to reassert themselves. And it's designed by the founders, I think, to do that. I mean, the point at which you got 20 senators telling Trump, back off of sessions. We're not going to move forward with that. You're not going to do that. Not on our watch. I think that's a healthy sign, and one that we should feel some optimism about, and hope that it continues.
Okay. Other news, of course, today. John Kelly was sworn in as the new White House chief of staff, reporting, of course, directly to President Trump. The question is, who's reporting to him and who's already going around him to get directly to the president? But let's listen to just a few of the remarks the president had to make at a cabinet meeting in which Kelly was introduced.
I predict that General Kelly will go down in terms of the position of chief of staff, one of the great ever, and we're going to have a good time, but much more importantly, we're going to work hard, and we're going to make America great again. It's all about making America great again. That's what we're going to do. That's what I said. That's how we won this big election, and that's what we're in the process of doing and continuing. And General, it's really great to have you on board, and thank you very much.
President Trump staying on message. By the way, Jim Galloway, Tamara Hallerman, this is the first time a general has occupied the position of chief of staff since Al Haig was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, and we all know how that turned out.
As of now, I am in control here in the White House.
Al Haig, tomorrow, one of his more infamous moments, unfortunately, after the assassination attempt on President Reagan. And Al Haig will be remembered forever, despite anything he might have done that was good in that job, for having made that unfortunate statement. And in fact, it bled into his presidential campaign. It never died, Tamar.
Good. I'm glad you know it was before I was born.
That's the value of multi-generational panels.
Yeah. Jim, you were born.
I was born. We remember. Every now and then, we threaten to name our dog Al Haig because he always thinks he's in control.
Yeah. Well, So more seriously, what are we expecting from General Kelly when he's dealing with a guy as volatile as President Trump?
I don't know that we can expect anything. I think we can hope for a little bit of message discipline, structural discipline. I think you still have I don't know if it's been resolved, but you still have a communications director recently hired who has a direct report to the president. And if that remains, then I think the problem still is still there. Brian could probably fill us in on a little bit more of this, on how chiefs of staff work. Particularly in a governor's office. Does Chris Riley control access to the governor?
Oh, there's no question. You had to work for one of the toughest chiefs of staff that we've seen in Georgia in a very long time.
There are different models for the position, and the model that Governor Deal and Chris Riley have is one with a really strong chief of staff. Pretty much all access to the governor goes through him. And there are ups and downs to every model. The ups to that is it's highly efficient. Mm-hmm. There's a a controlled flow to the governor of what he hears and doesn't hear. And when the chief of staff makes a pronouncement, he's speaking on behalf of the governor, and the trains can begin to move. So there, you know, you don't see the chaos in the Dill administration that you see in the Trump administration. Now, that's not going to be the model in the White House, because that's not how President Trump is going to operate. He's not going to empower someone in that manner. And so this, we'll see how the Scaramucci thing works out with him having direct access. I think that with the new chief of staff, there needs to be a reworking of this where everything goes through Kelly.
You know what, Nan, it's interesting. There's been a lot of focus on people like Scaramucci, whether he's going to be able to get in line with a Kelly. There's concern about the president's daughter and son-in-law and whether they're going to, you know, be able to work through the new chief of staff. Yeah, but I was thinking about something interesting, and it goes back to Reagan again. Ronald Reagan had James Baker. He had some very, one of the model for a chief of staff. He also, though, had Don Regan. And the reality in that White House was there was no advisor closer to the president than his wife, Nancy Reagan. And she's revered today for the impact she had on his presidency. There were times when things went awry.
Yeah, didn't she consult with astrologers?
Yeah, of course. Uh-huh. But yes. Yet we think very fondly about the fact that a member of the president's family was also in the inner circle. We do not give that same tribute to the current president and his family.
Well, I'll tell you, things that are happening now are in no way normal, and I don't want to be a part of pretending that they are. This is not a normal situation in Washington. The words of this new alleged communication director alone should have turned the nation on its head to hear that kind of that kind of filthy gutter language.
Yeah, I wasn't suggesting that either Jared Kushner or Trump's daughter Ivanka are doing wonderful things in the White House. Just that we have had in past administrations family members working closely.
But I will tell you what, I don't think in those cases, with the case of Nancy Reagan, I don't think it was knowledge based influence. But it's supposed to be knowledge based influence when it comes to Ivanka and to Jared.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that makes a big difference.
All right, let me turn now to you, Tamar. First of all, you had a ringside seat for what must have been one of the most extraordinary nights any journalist could have hoped to have been hovering around the United States Senate. What was that like?
Well, I had the misfortune of going to bed at 11:30 that night. I thought that vote would
and
come at the
end. And she's an honest person.
I'm an honest person. But I will say, as somebody who studied the tape after.
She woke up early.
I woke up early and studied the tape. And that's about as dramatic as it gets in the U.S. Senate. I mean, what a show. It was still subtle. There's no rushing of the well like what happened in the House last year when the Democrats had their sit-in over gun control. But to hear the audible gasps when McCain walked up to the front and stuck his finger down to say he would vote no. You could see David Perdue, who was presiding over the chamber in that moment, kind of dip his head, shake it a little bit. You saw McConnell to his left, you know, with his arms crossed, his cheeks getting pink, you know, so just livid. You see Bill Cassidy, another Republican, with his head down. You see Elizabeth Warren standing up and clapping, and Chuck Schumer kind of waving her down to be quiet. It was extraordinary.
Yeah, it's interesting about it, though. We thought that was the dramatic conclusion for the time being for to do anything about health care. And the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, said, let's move on. It's time to move on. And yet, over the weekend, tomorrow, the president began again berating Congress, insulting members of the Republican Party in the Senate, and insisting that there should be no other business conducted until they finally got something resolved with a repeal and replace. And Mick Mulvaney, his budget director, reinforced that message on CNN with Jake Tapper on Sunday morning.
Is this official White House policy that nothing should be voted on in Congress, not even the debt ceiling, before the Senate votes again on health care?
Well, I think yes. And I think what you're seeing there is the president simply reflecting the mood of the people. Go and poll the American public and find out what the most important issue is to them right now, and it's health care. So in the White House's view, they can't move on in the Senate. In the people's view, they should move on in the Senate. They should stay and work and figure out a way to solve this problem. Keep in mind, you're talking about something they've promised to do for 7 years. You can't promise folks you're going to do something for 7 years and then not do it.
Tamar, if you're a member of the Senate, a Republican in the Senate, you have got to right now be completely exasperated that the president is trying to drag you back to an issue that you have said, look, we don't have the votes, we can't get it done. Yes?
Yes and no. You know, you have a lot of Republicans who have voted with the president and with the Republican leadership on a variety of different plans, all of them with the common denominator to strip away large parts of Obamacare, who don't understand why some of their more moderate colleagues are voting no. So I think they are kind of scared to go back home and not have anything in their hands to show their voters. August is town hall season, and there are plenty of videos from this spring of very angry constituents screaming at their members of Congress. So a lot of them don't want to go home empty-handed.
Well, I know Tamar knows this, but just to our audience, there's screaming by people who don't want to see their only access to health care monkeyed with by Congress. And Tamar opened up a Political Insider comments with examples of Georgians facing Crohn's disease, facing dire medical situations, that understand that if this goes up in smoke, they don't know what the future holds for them. And those people are showing up at town halls all across the country.
Let me ask you, if I could jump in and direct something over at Brian. yesterday morning, Sunday morning, you had Alan Peake, state representative out of Macon, a Republican, say, look, it's nobody's going to get what they want on health care, that Republicans are going to have to bend a little bit, Democrats are going to have to bend, but he seemed to be adopting the John Kasich line that it's got to be something that that's accomplished by people working together. Do you sense the attitude in the Georgia legislature changing to the point that the state could successfully ask for a waiver and expand Medicaid in this climate?
I don't, and I think it's because there's still a lot of uncertainty. And I think if Congress takes actions that sort of put us in a position where we have no choice, I think then it becomes. But there's not a lot of appetite heading into an election year to go into your Republican primary having expanded Medicaid. But I will say this, on that issue, if we went to the direction that the House went on its repeal and replace, which essentially punishes Georgia and other non-expansion states moving forward, mm-hmm. that it would be irresponsible almost to not do it at the last minute take the extra money, because it's going to be divided up in the future based on how much money you're getting at that moment.
And we're at the bottom of the barrel, Georgia.
We're at the bottom of the barrel. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, we have taken the conservative Republican path. We have done the things that Republican-led states have done. We've done the exact same thing. A Republican Congress should not be punishing states that did the conservative thing, which is where we are now. So that's what I don't understand in all of this. As a Republican myself, I don't know what victory is for us on the federal level with repeal and replace. Is it just completely dismantling the system? There doesn't seem to be any appeal to that. Even on the far right, they understand there's going to be something that's still left there. So what is it? Is it doing away with Medicaid expansion across the country? Is it doing away with the exchanges? What is victory? And I don't think there's anybody on our side who is articulating that, and the president needs to.
You know what's interesting? Rand Paul just today, I believe, heard that he's offered as one of the possible scenarios going forward is that actually go through the committee process and start hammering out bit by painful bit a new policy that can be owned by both Democratic and Republican members of the Congress. And that's pretty interesting opening that he's creating there. And Kasich, of course, has been calling for that.
I want to say this, that all of us in this business and probably across the country are so tired of the polarized system
the
of our politics,
sure, yeah,
where nothing gets done, where everybody stands on their extremes and no one comes to the middle. Maybe health care is that issue that breaks through that logjam. Now, here's going to be the holdup. Democrats have no incentive to work with President Trump or Republicans in Congress, and both sides are to blame on this. Certainly McConnell fought Obama every step of the way. No doubt about it. It's both sides. But if Democrats will put politics aside, and their political calculation is fight Trump, fight Trump, fight Trump. But if they'll put that aside, they can have a major say in how this gets done and how this gets fixed. Just like Stacey Abrams in Georgia had a say in how Hope got fixed because she was willing to come to the table.
I got to get to a break, but tomorrow I want to get one other thing accomplished on health care before we do that. The president over the weekend and then again this morning reinforced in a tweet his feeling that if the Senate isn't going to do anything to repeal and replace, maybe the insurance companies and Congress should pay a price. He's suggesting, certainly with members of Congress who have to be part of the exchanges by law, that was part of the Obamacare law, that maybe the government should stop giving them subsidies. Threatening on something as fundamental as health care, is that going to be a very workable solution to getting people together tomorrow?
I mean, that's going to hit their staff, you know, just as much as it hits the members
sure.
of Congress. And these are a lot of these staffers are people who are not paid so well, you know, $30,000 a year. But even more critically about what the president was saying this weekend is that he wanted to cut off these payments to insurance companies. On the one hand, it makes a good slogan, but that's money that's intended to lower the price for poor people. So if those payments go away, then people are estimating that poorer people, their premiums will shoot up by 20%.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I do want to come back from the break and just spend a couple more minutes on this issue because Tom Price commented on that very thing on Meet the Press this weekend, and we ought to talk a bit about it. But let's get a break out of the way. We're really late in doing that. We'll stop just for a minute and come right back.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta, September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Joining us from the Washington Bureau of the AJC, Tamar Hallerman. Here in the studio, her colleague, political writer Jim Galloway, Senator Nan Orrick, and, of course, Republican Brian Robinson. A real quick bit of breaking news. Our friend Tim Echols, the Public Service Commissioner, tweets us a big story about nuclear power.
South Carolina,
Santee
right.
Cooper and yes. ScanaCorp are abandoning efforts to build the 2 new nuclear reactors in South Carolina. It follows the problems here with Toshiba backing away from not being bankrupt.
Right, and that means now the only 2 new nuclear reactors under construction are in Georgia.
And yeah. sucking money out of the consumers' pockets every month on our bill.
Yeah, Echols tweets, and we'll have to follow up on this, that perhaps this will take some pressure off here. I would be interesting to see exactly how
that
would
I think
work.
It was the fact that Westinghouse, the bankrupt company, was working both sites, and this reduces it.
All right.
I would think Nan would be all over nuclear power since it
Not
does.
Not at all. I don't swallow the line of the industry that it's clean.
It's clean.
No, and it's not clean.
It does not contribute to global warming, which is the cause du jour of the left.
Do you know that we have 50 million gallons of highly radioactive nuclear waste sitting over there at the head of the Savannah River in the bomb plant that they have not dealt with, cannot deal with? That's on the military side.
All right, let's.
He didn't want to ask me. He really didn't want to go down that road with me.
No, he didn't, but he did.
Tamar,
let's go back to health care for a very important reason. You brought it up. I mean, is The question becomes, when President Trump says, as I've always said, let Obamacare fail, collapse, whatever words he's using, and then we'll have to start over. And the big question there, of course, is, does that mean that he would try to order the government to not pay the subsidies that allow poor people, poorer Americans, to get health insurance and therefore take money out of the pools and start a collapse that might have been avoidable? Tamar?
Potentially. I mean, his gamble that he's, you know, still deciding, I think, is whether it's worth the risk. On the one hand, yes, that would send the markets crashing, and potentially it will bring Democrats to the negotiating table. But on the other hand, he's risking all of this being, you know, all the blame being pinned on him. So it's no small gamble here.
But when we were on break, Brian made the point that November is the season for re-upping on your insurance, and that's likely to become the timing when Republicans really take ownership of health care.
And not only that, but in the middle of August, coming up in a few weeks, is when insurers have to decide exactly how much they want to charge people in 2018. So if they see Trump saying, maybe I'll cut it off, premiums could already shoot up. Maybe Trump doesn't even need to do anything for that to happen.
And the trick will be, if we go with that strategy, that we just let Obamacare implode on itself, which is going to mean Americans paying much higher premiums and much higher deductibles, much more money out of their pockets. Who do Americans blame? Do we go to our tribal corners and the Democrats blame Republicans, Republicans blame Democrats? Or is there one side in this that is going to get hammered? Is it the Democrats who get hammered because it's their system, or is it the Republicans who get hammered because they promised to fix it and didn't? I don't know the answer to that.
I've got one possibility, and that is Republicans start to cut Trump loose, and both sides go after the president.
Well, you know, it is interesting, Nan, and this has also been speculated about over the weekend since Reince Priebus. Reince Priebus,
yes,
was President Trump's really only tie to the Republican Party.
Yeah, he and Sean Spicer.
Right, but Spicer being one of Priebus's guys. So now Trump is operating, can operate, free of party affiliation in many ways, yes?
And wouldn't hesitate to do so. It's very interesting. I mean, the bully boy tactics of a New York real estate developer don't play well in the White House. And this shoving around people, demeaning people, treating Jeff Sessions, of whom I'm no particular fan, but treating Jeff Sessions in the manner that he's been treated, you know, publicly embarrassing people when he wants to get rid of them. Every other thing out of his Twitter account is to attack Republican lawmakers over there, threaten them. I don't think that is going to last. I think that's going to run its course, and there'll be consequences.
All right. If I can, let's move on to stories that are closer to home within the region and yet have national implications as well. One of them, this was really interesting. Politico this morning, Jim, had a piece about Mitch McConnell being under siege in the Alabama Republican primary, which is, of course, being held as a special election to replace Jeff Sessions in the U.S. Senate.
Yes.
And you've got two right-wing Republicans, Mo Brooks and, talk about right-wingers, a former Alabama Supreme Court Justice Roy Moore, and both of them are going to battle over Mitch McConnell. They want him gone.
Right, and so you have Mitch McConnell pumping, I think the figure was $8 million into Luther Strange's
re-election. Luther Strange was the guy who was appointed by the governor to fill the seat temporarily.
Right, just before the governor resigned because of his indiscretions.
That's what we say.
And that was serving Luther Strange poorly. He was, and I believe he's still struggling in polls, as a matter of fact. Because there's a feeling in Alabama that he's part of the collusion.
Tamar, I don't think they're going to pump the money into this race because it's not a Republican versus Democrat race. But on the other hand, there is something in some ways I would think up there. Got to be watching this race in which two candidates are pounding at Majority Leader McConnell. like many people, watch the 6th District race in Georgia.
Well, they're doing it too, Bill, and right here in the they're doing it in the face of their hallowed Senator Jeff Sessions being treated like dirt by this president.
Tomorrow, going to be a big race to watch up there, isn't it?
Absolutely, because Mitch McConnell wants people who will be on his side. He does not want more headaches a la Ted Cruz or Mike Lee from Utah. He wants people who he can, for better or worse, control. If somebody like Mo Brooks comes in, he's going to have to work so much harder to keep him on board for various things when it comes to taxes or health care. So he wants an ally, and he sees Luther Strange as his ally.
Two things on that. One, when our very own Senator David Perdue was elected, he had been noncommittal about whether he would vote for Mitch McConnell as majority leader. And so it took some time for him to patch that up with the majority leader after he got to Washington as our senator. So McConnell does keep a very close eye on what is said about him in these races, which makes sense. And the other thing is that, you know, Jim mentioned Mo Brooks, who is a House member running for that Senate seat. Mo Brooks said something really interesting at the end of last week that I had thought about. Yeah. Jeff Sessions could just do the ultimate middle finger to the president, step down from AG and run for Senate and go back on Senate Judiciary.
And, right, and Mo Brooks says he's fine with that. He'll
Brooks said if he could get Roy Moore and Luther Strange to form a pact that he would step aside so Jeff Sessions can oh my gosh. Lisa Clark has just brought in, I'm sorry, we have to stop everything else because the New York Times is reporting President Trump has decided to remove Anthony Scaramucci as communications
director. Oh, my God.
Oh, my.
No, you're kidding me.
As requested
of course.
By the new chief of staff, John Kelly.
Wow.
That's got to be the shortest tenure.
Mooch, we hardly knew yet.
Are the Chinese still going to buy him out? His share in his
But, okay, so tomorrow, that's fascinating because that was the question, wasn't it? Could John Kelly possibly control somebody as volatile as Anthony Scaramucci? And clearly, in his first day on the job, Kelly is saying, I am in charge. He's saying what Haig did. I'm in control here.
What you'd expect from a four-star Marine general,
What do you think, Tamar?
And that's a huge vote of confidence from President Trump in his new chief of staff.
That's
that
right.
He's willing to listen. Scaramucci was his guy from New York, his kind of mini-me. So that's huge. Yeah.
Wow. All right. I guess we got a sense of where this – we may see a different White House with John Kelly in charge.
Well, we had just discussed in the first segment about how you couldn't have a communications director reporting directly to the president around the chief of staff.
Yeah.
Boom. They must have been listening.
Okay. The story that I wanted to get to that I think is really interesting before we close out the national news, but again, we got a good Georgia angle, is Jim, over the weekend, the New York Times carried an op-ed from Sally Yates, who, of course, is well-known to people here in Georgia, and was fired by the president as acting attorney general. And just to quote a paragraph, her message is protect the Justice Department from President Trump. And here's just a few lines. The president is attempting to dismantle the rule of law, destroy the time-honored independence of the Justice Department, and undermine the career men and women who are devoted to seeking justice day in and day out, regardless of which political party is in power. If we're not careful, when we wake up from the Trump presidency, our justice system may be broken beyond repair. And here's a crucial moment. President Trump's actions appear aimed at destroying the fundamental independence of the Justice Department, all the while he's ripped the blindfold off Lady Justice and is attempting to turn the department into a sword to seek vengeance against his perceived enemies and a shield to protect him and his allies.
Phew. Sally.
That's strong language. And it's, you know, it's she's you see her kind of slowly working her way out onto the public stage, and this is another step. It's not outside her purview. She's not talking she's keeping her focus very narrow, and I think she's on point.
Well, I just give a shout out to women for the week. We haven't said anything about it today, but that healthcare vote would have never happened the way it happened had it not been for two women in the U.S. Senate the Alaska senator and the
Lisa
senator
Murkowski
from Maine. That's right.
And
Murkowski
Susan
and
Collins.
Susan Collins. And we had for a minute Senator Capito from West Virginia with him until she got stampeded away. And McCain could not have done what he did had it not been for those women being resolute, unmoved, personally attacked in the case of the Murkowski. And here we have the clarion call, a clear-headed voice from Sally Yates, a woman of high integrity and a record of accomplishment. Women in public places and at policy tables make a difference.
You know, Brian, it's interesting that Jim said here she is edging out of front, maybe on the public stage, but very cautiously. And he obviously leads to a question about, does this mean that we're eventually going to see her run for public office? I'm still convinced that is not who Sally Yates is in her very core. But...
Well, she certainly has been very consistent in her public remarks that she has no interest in running for office. And there is a big difference between being an appointed position as where you are essentially staff, which is what my career has been largely, and putting your name on a ballot. It's a different skill set. It takes a different type of drive to do it. And it takes a different sort of self-image to do it. And I just don't see that as she doesn't appear to be someone for whom this is a burning desire. But she's obviously competent. She's obviously very capable.
But she would be a very, very popular choice for U.S. Attorney General in the next Democratic administration.
She's well set up for that and would be very well received by Democrats across the country. You know, if she wants to run, maybe what she's doing is waiting. She's still in her prime years. She's not in her sunset. So maybe she's waiting until Georgia hits that demographic tipping point where Democrats have a much better chance of winning here. On Meet the Press yesterday, they pointed out that there are a couple of states where Trump has 20-something point approval ratings in red states.
Yeah, plus 20. Yeah.
In Wyoming, West Virginia, North mm-hmm. Dakota. But in Arizona, Texas, and Georgia, mm-hmm. all red states since the Reagan years, he's underwater. So Sally Yates and people like her are keeping an eye on those types of numbers.
Tomorrow, we're going to move on to some more state issues. But before we do, I want to get a sense from you. David Perdue felt he had won a big victory. And he had made a good fight to get the Senate, at least, to stay in session into the first couple weeks of August. He has always felt strongly they don't spend enough time up there. They're coming home too often. And he certainly thought they should take the time to actually do something legislatively, to have something to show for their work up there. Well, obviously, the collapse of the health care bill sends everybody home. How long does this recess last, and what are we expecting is going to be happening as members of Congress are sort of talking among themselves before they come back up to the Hill?
Sure. So traditionally, this August recess lasts about 5 weeks, and the House just left. They're going to have their full 5 weeks. Perdue had secured a promise that on the Senate side, it would only be a 3-week break. It looks like that's going to get shaved down, so they'll be gone for a full month. And look, they're gonna go home. They traditionally spend that time meeting with businesses, meeting with constituents. I think a lot of them are gonna get hammered on both sides, not only from Democrats who are so angry that they've come this close to changing the healthcare system, but from Republicans who said, you know, we gave you a majority in the House and the Senate. We gave you the White House, and you still couldn't get it done. I don't think a lot of these Republican lawmakers want to go home right now.
Well, they just voted for a bill that has a lower than 20% approval rating from the American public. They ought to be a little bit ambivalent about going home.
I think we're going to see a minimum of town hall meetings.
Oh, yeah. And I think you're going to see a lot of talk about how people still want to meet in D.C., these little ad hoc working groups where, they're trying to figure something out. Who knows how serious those efforts are, but as long as they can keep showing constituents, hey, we're still working on this issue, they're hoping that can buy them some goodwill.
Well, you know, the Georgia Hospital Association, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, it's certainly a big player in Georgia's health economy. From all the Georgia governor, you're hearing from Perdue and Isaacson are hearing from a number of sectors in Georgia. Slow the roll here and don't make mistakes that could fatally damage our healthcare infrastructure and our economy.
And I want to say on that, that Isaacson and Perdue did listen to the Georgia Hospital Association and medical providers in this state and made some improvements on what the House did. As I mentioned earlier, the House version hurts states that did not expand Medicaid, which no Republican Congress should do, in my opinion. They should find a way to accommodate us and make it fair for us as non-expansion states. That's the best way forward. That's something that Congress could do constructively. But knowing what the House did, Perdue and Isaacson went in and reinstated payments to hospitals that serve high levels of Medicaid patients and are people who don't pay at all.
Indigent care, yeah.
Yeah, it's called DISH, which is a fancy acronym, but it goes to these hospitals. So Isaacson and Perdue are leading on that issue.
All right,
going off of that, just one quick point, if you have the time.
Sure, go ahead.
The issue is that Isaacson and Perdue's votes were never in doubt for Mitch McConnell, so their negotiating stance was a little bit limited. Brian, you mentioned earlier about how some of the states that did expand Medicaid, how they were getting the lion's share of the benefits. The issue there was that those senators were the ones who were in danger of abandoning support for this bill, so McConnell had to give them a lot to even get them on board. The problem is that Isaacson and Perdue were always going to be team players and vote for this bill.
I don't disagree with that.
Okay. We do have to get a break in. You can tweet us. People have been at Politics GPB. Tim Echols responded. We talked about his tweet about the fact that now the South Carolina, the company is building, those reactors have collapsed. Galloway has it right. Georgia gets more workers, greater focus, and Southern Company has the wherewithal to manage construction. SCANA, which was building the South Carolina reactors, doesn't. Good job, Jim. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Tom Perata, author of the novels Little Children, Election, and The Leftovers, which was adapted into an HBO series. His new book, Mrs. Fletcher, is about a single mom and her son and how they both are transformed after he leaves home for college. The story is about major life transitions and the sexual transitions that can accompany them. Join us.
Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Back with Senator Nan Orrick, Brian Robinson, Jim Galloway, and Tamar Hallerman. Interesting column that you had this weekend, Jim, and I know you got some blowback over it. You wrote that the Democratic gubernatorial race looks like a matchup between...
It had the feel.
Yes.
May have the feel of a matchup between Beyonce and Taylor Swift.
And first of all, what you meant by that was what?
Well, you've got Ms. Abrams doing something very, very interesting on the Democratic side, something we have not seen. And that is, in politics, whether it's Republican or Democrat, you try to lead with the people you want, not the people you already have. You know, that's why you have Republicans who are always make sure there's minority members on the stage. And over the last, since 2002, we've had Roy Barnes at the top of the ticket. We've had Michelle Nunn in a prominent position. We've had Jason Carter in a prominent position. And the idea has been that you're after those white independent voters, okay? Stacey Abrams is doing something very different. She's trying to nationalize this governor's race. She's got some outside groups working with her, a triumvirate of African American organizations, who are trying to create this relationship between white progressive Democrats and African American women, and the focus of their campaign, the name of their campaign is Get Information. Which is
referring to the
Beyonce,
the song from Beyonce. Jim got some blowback from people who thought he was being a sexist in talking about two female candidates in terms of female entertainers, not to mention we got a racial divide here.
I think Stacey Abrams has the winning approach. Where we need to go to get the votes is this vast number of people that are Democratic when they vote, but that are not turning out. And I will ask you to look for a moment at the Jason Carter, Michelle Nunn race when they headed our ticket. They took exactly the same percentage of white votes that President Obama took in his race. The person who outperformed everybody else on that ticket was one Valerie Wilson for state school superintendent, who got more votes than Jason and Michelle. She broke out of the pack, and she was at the head. And she has a track. Check me. Jim. Mm-hmm. Jim's looking, not skeptically, but just wanting to look into it. I can see that in his face, and I hope you do. Because I think we're looking for a unicorn if we think we're going to win white voters away from the Trump crowd. What I saw, the progressive white voters in the Ossoff race are embracing a progressive agenda. They're bold. They want to move forward. They're not timid centrists that are maybe trying out a Democrat this time, maybe holding their breath. They were people who are enthusiastic. I know many of them are filing to run for office that I met in that campaign. And I think there's a growing progressive white vote in the state that embraces coalition with people of color.
And the question is, mm-hmm. if I have no doubt that a Democratic nomination can be won that way. I think that's very possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The question is whether how that translates into November, whether if you have heightened racial identity and you're moving your party to the left at the same time, mm-hmm. you know, does that benefit you in November?
Guess who was not excited by the Carter Nunn ticket?
Who?
African American vote did not perform at the level that it could have. And I represent many African-American communities, and I heard over and over people saying, well, we don't know them. We haven't seen them. What are they going to do? You know, it's the legacy punch of their candidacy, you know, grandson of a president, daughter of a U.S. senator.
Downton Abbey Democrats who thought they shouldn't inherit their titles. That's what I called them.
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting.
But Valerie Wilson outperformed them.
All right. So, you know, one of the things I wanted to say, Jim, it's interesting. We both have been in situations like this. People may have had a reason to criticize you, but mostly it sounded to me like they didn't actually read the column. They saw a tweet about the column, and they misunderstood what you were trying to say to some extent.
Yeah, if you read it, I think, you know, Nan is frowning.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't take an issue with that column. I thought that you surfaced a dynamic that is at play in that race. Absolutely surfaced it, and. And I say to you, where are we going to get our 200,000 votes that we need to have a Democratic victory in 2018? We're going to get it from millennial voters, women voters, people of color, communities of color, progressives, black and white.
We've been hearing this every cycle for at least 8 years now that this was on the horizon. And other than Trump's number, which did dip below what Republicans usually get in this state, we've been very consistently between 56 and the kind of drop down to about 53% of that. And that's what the Republican total is. There's nothing sea change happening right now that's going to make that very different. Basically, we're looking at the race for governor on the Democrat side to see which of these candidates y'all are going to pick to then lose to the Republicans.
We have not mentioned the other candidate, who's Stacey Evans on Smyrna, the mm-hmm. state rep.
Yeah.
Who's
not going to get out of the primary? Stacey is not going to get out of the primary, and I've shared my feelings with her on that. And I think it's wasting Stacey Evans. Thank you. Evans and Abrams. That's why.
Yeah, no first names here.
last names. I would love to see a Stacey ticket.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. At the top of two Stacey's running not against each other. But
well, y'all still don't have a lieutenant governor candidate, there's an opening
there
y'all's side.
I think that should make a very attractive lieutenant governor candidate.
Jim, Stacey Evans. Pick up on something else. We have very little time to do this, but it's the beginning of a conversation. You wrote in the Insider, I think you filed, or maybe Bluestein filed the story, Republican candidates starting to talk about state income tax, whether they should be abolished. It looks like this is going to surf and bubble up.
If it's August before a gubernatorial race, you're talking about the income tax. And of course, Governor Nathan Deal has cautioned everybody to watch their mouths on this topic. Mm-hmm. And that is because we're not Florida. We're not overridden by tourists who you can charge out the wazoo on taxes. We're not Tennessee. We don't have that economy. We have an economy that's pretty diverse when it comes to tax income.
And it's very reactionary to have a tax policy that's based on consumerism because that overtaxes the people on the lower income side.
Brian, you have a horse in this race, and I think I'm right. What's interesting is having worked for Nathan Deal, who did always say, be careful about tax giveaways. You're now involved with the Cagle campaign, and he's a proponent of elimination. Am I right? He's pro-elimination of the state income tax?
Well, he certainly indicated that in those comments at the GOP event in Cherokee last week. And you're right, my former boss has been fairly resilient against it, even came out against it when it was politically easier to be for it in 2010 and 2014 when those issues came up. There's merit on both sides. You know, if we do away with it, one thing that we benefit from is the world's richest people all of a sudden have an incentive to come live here, whereas they won't do it now because they can move to Palm Beach and have a great place and not pay any income tax. Or they can move to Nashville and not pay any income tax. So it does open up those venues to bring in the Uber. And so we get tax revenue.
And we get what from that?
Property taxes.
All right. I got to cut that off because we are really out of time on today's show. Tamar Hallerman, Jim Galloway, Brian Robinson, Senator Nan Orrick, it's really a pleasure to have you here for a great discussion today with not one but two breaking news stories. This South Carolina nuclear reactor meltdown. Not a meltdown. I mean the finance.
Metaphor.
Financial meltdown.
And the dismissal of Scaramucci. I'd love to negotiate the contract that he's going to get with a cable network because, boy, he's going to get paid a fortune, whoever takes him on.
Whoever wants the potty mouth.
Thank you to Jenny Ament, to Olivia Rheingold, to Tyler Morris, and Lisa Clark. Catherine Cummings tweeted that she loved the music that you chose for the start of the show, an orchestration of Queen. And, of course, the lyric in that song is, Scaramouche, Scaramouche, can you do a fandango? I think I've got that right.
That's applause all around for that one,
right? We are back with you on Wednesday at 2 o'clock. Greg Bluestein, a Buddy Darden, who has not been in for a good part of the summer, is going to be back with us. So we're excited about seeing. It's always fun to have Buddy in the studio. Then Thursday on our new weekday edition of Two Way Street at 2 o'clock, I think we have a really good show lined up for you. Our guest is Lawrence Wright, who won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Looming Tower, which was a book that told you about how Al-Qaeda started, how it got to the terrible events of 9/11. He wrote Going Clear, a book about Scientology, and he's got a brand new book about the terror years from Al-Qaeda to the Islamic State. He'll be with us on Thursday. We recorded that conversation with him in front of a packed auditorium at the Atlanta History Center, and they seem to like it. I think you will, too. So thanks for being with us today. We'll see you again Wednesday at 2 for another Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut.